Yes, the next real talk within the session, Global Perspectives. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Marianne Martone. She got a BA from Wesley College, then went to UC San Diego, where she obtained a PhD in 93. And as she just told me, she stayed there and stayed there. So she also got a faculty position there. She has pronounced interest in neuroanatomy using light and electron microscopy, interested in morphology, protein localization, and I think all the way down from very, very small systems to the entire brain. And she has not stayed within the classical or modern neuroanatomy, but also discovered that neuroinformatics might play an important role in this endeavor, and that in some way also closes the loop from this week back to the INCF meeting that started this Computational Neuroscience and Neuroinformatics Week here in Munich. Marianne has been very productive within the BERN initiative and also in the NIF, which is the Neuroscience Information Framework, a huge and quite successful approach, started out in the US and then also got integrated into INCF, where she is representing the United States. And it's a great honor to have you here and hear what you tell us about your work, big data from small data. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andreas. Is this on? Yes? Okay, and thank you very much for inviting me. I've had a lovely week in Munich and a lot of data and numbers stuffed into my head. And I'm sure many of you did as well. My talk is a little bit different today. It's not going to focus so much on modeling, but more on the data that are, of course, integral for us to have access to if we're going to develop appropriate models. And as Andreas said, I'm going to talk to you from the perspective of a project that's called the Neuroscience Information Framework. So it's impossible to start off any talk in informatics without some overarching slide that tells us of all the different levels of which the nervous system operates and all the different data that we need to integrate. And this was from a piece that I published with Huda Akil and David Van Essen in an issue of the journal Science that was devoted to the data problem. And I thought Huda had this lovely phrase called neural choreography, which basically takes place of that diagram where we go from brains and behavior all the way down to the individual molecules. And neurochoreography, of course, indicates that it's impossible to take a purely reductionist approach if we're going to understand the nervous system. This is my pointer, yes. If we're going to understand the nervous system, but it requires that we integrate all this marvelous data across scales. And David Van Essen and Huda, of course, who have been involved in neuroinformatics from its very inception, said that neuroscientists are not really taking advantage of a lot of the data resources that were out there. There were a lot of data resources that were that have been produced because we've recognized that we're going to need, as that lovely film showed us, computers as our allies in this endeavor. But in fact, we find that most neuroscientists are largely ignorant of them and also don't necessarily know how to use them. So we have a lovely phrase like neural choreography, and this makes us envision of beautiful dancing, coordinated ballerinas or chorus lines. But in fact, in that same issue, there was a warning that what I call data choreography is actually not so easy to do and not so lovely and choreographed and put together. So in the same issue of Science, and you saw this across all fields, not just neuroscience, there was this recognition that whereas scientists have become very, very adept and have polished the art of publishing narrative in the form of papers, they're not so good at publishing data. And in fact, this is a new skill if you really want to think about it. It's not something that we've had to do routinely before except in the context of our papers. And what they often say is that a lot of the data is terrible. It's very difficult to integrate. It's very difficult to find. There are no metadata standards. And that people are starting to recognize it's a growing challenge to ensure, in fact, that data that are produced during a reported study are appropriately described, standardized, archived, and available to all. So this is a particularly acute problem in the neuroscientists because neuroscience encompasses everything. And the approach, of course, that everybody keeps pointing to as a success failing to recognize that it has taken them over well over a decade to get it implemented is in bioinformatics, where we have one basically simple data type, a sequence, and we have large databases through NCBI and EBI and other institutes that are able to offer these in a form where people can do computation on them. In the neurosciences, we don't just deal with sequence. Indeed, the early days of neuroinformatics ignored sequence because it felt it was well covered. But we deal with images and physiological traces and molecular traces and whole brain imaging. So it was unlikely that the neurosciences were going to be served by single large databases such as those at EBI. But the question is, what should it be served by? So there was a large investment around the world, and we've seen plenty of these things, beautiful resources here at this meeting, in creating an infrastructure, a computational infrastructure, for different fields of neuroscience to share their data. I'm not going to talk so much about the sociological aspects of sharing data, because that's an entirely different talk. But here we're just sort of we're talking about the fact that there were a lot of things that were created for free sharing and for people to access data. And the NIH Neural Institutes, of which there are 16 approximately in the United States, realized at one point that they kept funding these things, and they kept funding these things, and everybody kept saying, we need more of them and more of them. And they said, well, you know, how many did we actually fund? It actually turned out that NIH, up until recently, had no infrastructure for even easily tracking what grants they funded. Again, we were used to sort of working in these cocoons and these silos. So the NIF project was originally started because somebody apparently asked, didn't I fund that already? And nobody knew what the answer was, because nobody knew it was actually funded. They were very difficult to find. So the Neuroscience Information Framework initially was just a cataloging project and said, how many of these things are out there? What fields do they cover? What fields do they not cover? How can we find them? Where are they? Are people putting data online? Is there a large call for a data sharing platform? Who uses them? Who creates them? And more importantly, how can we find them? And is there something that we can do to make them better? So first, how many are there? I'd like to show this slide. This is from NIF's continuing cataloging effort. So the current version of NIF has been online since 2008. We're just finishing our fourth year. And over that time, human curators and friends and colleagues and various people around the world have identified, predominantly in the United States and Europe, at least 5,000 of these resources. And by resources, I don't mean just databases and data sets, but also software materials and other sorts of things. But of these, about 2,000 are databases. And these are supposed to be databases of relevance to neuroscience, and that, of course, is a relative term, what is relevant to neuroscience. But the whole point of informatics, of course, is to sort of get away from this siloed idea that what is relevant in one domain has no relevance to the other. So we took a fairly broad view, because there are a lot of sequence databases and things, obviously, if you're going to look at genes in the brain, you're going to compare them to other things. But really, there are a lot of these databases. And just the pure logistics suggests that you are not going to be able to visit all 2,000 of these yourself. So if you have a piece of information that is scattered amongst several different databases, how are you ever going to find it? And the first thing that everybody always tells me as soon as I give a talk like this, they're like, yeah, but we have Google. What about Google? Have you ever thought of that? That's one I always like. It's like, have you ever thought of using Google for this? I'm like, of course we've thought of using Google for this. We use Google for this every single day. And after 4 years of looking, we are still finding new things. And part of that is because, A, the web, which is a very fabulous thing, really was designed for sharing documents. It wasn't so much designed for sharing data, and that is deep access to the contents of what we would consider data. And there are efforts underway, like the Semantic Web and others, to change that and use the web as a data place. But right now, a lot of what we would call data are stored in databases, relational databases that have a dynamic interface. So you don't just go to a web page where it exists, you go to a web page where there's a query box, and you issue a query, and it goes and assembles a view of that data and presents to you. It doesn't live at a stable URL, and if it doesn't live at a stable URL, then Google can't find it. So a lot of what is out there and has been produced is part of what we consider the hidden web, or the deep web, whatever you want to call it. So when we started the NIF system, we realized that if we couldn't get into these databases, that in fact we were going to be missing most of the information. It is very difficult to characterize a database by a few key words. You really need to be able to get in and access the content of it. But we had a few rules for NIF, because all of us were involved in various attempts over the years to create e-science and infrastructures for e-science and deep integration of databases. And we realized that we don't really know what exactly we're doing in this area. The technology is going very, very fast. And every resource that we encounter is what we call resource limited. And in this sense, I'm using the word resource as time, money, and personnel. So we never saw a group that could say, oh, you know, that's a really good idea. Let me tear down my whole infrastructure and implement yours. And then next year you'll tell them, well, we know we got that wrong, and now you need to do this instead. There are no labs out there where people are sitting around twiddling their thumbs waiting and can afford to devote time. So we said, if we really want to understand what's going on inside this deep web, we've got to be able to get access to a lot of it quickly. So NIF was really designed with the idea that it needed to work with resources as they were, that we were going to get limited time and attention from the resource providers, no matter how willing they were, simply because nobody had extra money or personnel sitting around. So we created a platform that was allowed, that essentially, the key thing, allowed us to populate it very, very quickly. And as you know, whenever you populate something quickly, you have to make compromises, and things are not done as well as they could. But we had been involved in a lot of the similar types of projects where after 5 years, they're like, yeah, I got two databases integrated, and we're like, that's good. You know, what about the other 2,000? So it was designed to be done very fast. And I would say that NIF largely succeeded. Over the course of these 4 years, NIF's actually grown into what we call the largest searchable collation of neuroscience information on the web. We have about 180 of these databases and derived databases that are queryable through the NIF interface. We also make it possible to query the NIF registry, the catalog of information, because we can't get to them all. And we query the literature, too, recognizing that most neuroscience information is still contained in the literature. So NIF is a portal that's designed to allow you to find things for you to do your research. It's really geared towards researchers. And again, it was designed to be done fast so that we would be able to survey the neuroscience data landscape and say, what does it really make sense to do, right? What is it? What data sources are valuable? What aren't valuable? What can we do with the ones that are there? So independent of the platform that we've developed, we've learned a few things about operating in this environment. And one of the things I like to point out is that we've actually assembled a reservoir of cross-disciplinary biomedical data expertise that is somewhat unique. And the reason I say it's somewhat unique, and this will be a theme again of my talk, is that most researchers are focused on the problem at hand, and it's what tools can I assemble to answer my particular question. There are very few people that sit and look across the entire landscape for neuroscience, and as you can see, even by the NIH structure, where you have one institute of heart, lung, and blood, and one institute of digestive diseases, and 16 neural institutes, that not even in the United States at the governmental level does anybody bother to look across the entire neuroscience landscape. It's a very fractured domain. So I like to say that most of what we've accomplished right now, we haven't solved the search problem and the integration problem, but we've learned an awful lot. So what have we learned? Okay. Again, data comes in many shapes and sizes, and as I indicated before, when NIF search, it says we are going to be agnostic as to where data or materials and services are. If most of them are published in the literature, we're going to search the literature. That's just what we need to do. But most of the effort in NIF really went into this middle paddle here, which is the NIF Data Federation. These are these 180 databases that we've put together, and we have to add, by contract, about 25 to 30 per year. So we add a lot of them, and we add a lot of them fast. So let's look a little bit in more depth inside the NIF Data Federation. So if you look in the NIF Data Federation and just the rough data types, and data type is defined very loosely, not so much in a programmatic sense, but more what sort of thing is this thing trying to give us access to, you see that there's all kinds of things that are out there. By far and away, the dominant types of resources that are out there, the most data we have, are in the area of microarrays. Oh, that's outside. So we have over 3 million microarray records. We have 9 or 10 microarray databases. As we will see, they're all not unique. They sort of import each other's content and things. But if we look at this tiny sliver and look at the rest of NIF, we see that there are pathway databases, model organism databases, a lot of things for images, drug databases, antibodies, and a lot of information about where you can find grants and what grants have been funded. So we have a lot of information on that. And I always like to joke, the reason why I know that our clientele is largely research scientists is our number one access source is funding opportunities. That's what people come to look for, okay? So we have quite a bit and quite an array of things. And I should also say, I need to define what do I mean by data. And that's because a lot of people come to NIF and they're like, you don't have data. You have metadata, you have, I don't know what you want, catalogs. And I said, well, it really depends on what you mean by data. And yes, NIF is a data federation. That is, we store some of the data locally, but a lot of it is out in the domain resources. So sometimes we don't present the metadata through NIF, but it's certainly out there. But actually, if you look at the types of data resources that people are providing, they're creating a whole lot of different resources depending upon the purpose of the resource and the type of data that they're sharing. So the ones that everybody thinks about in terms of data are what we would call primary data. And even that becomes a little bit of a semantic challenge, but it is basically the thing you do the analysis on. So we have databases that are full of MRI images, microarray data sets, microscopic images. There are a few physiology databases that actually give you the wave traces. But a lot of them also give you secondary data, or what I'm calling secondary data. And these really are abstractions of very complex data that are difficult to parse, like images. And a good example of this, even though somebody would say, what do you mean the Allen Brain Atlas is there? You can get access to the raw data, you can get access to the images. And that's true, but a lot of the analysis you do on abstracted data that they pre-computed for you so that you can compare across all these slices. You tend not to use the slices themselves. You have a lot of people who have extracted information from the literature, taking this unstructured data and turning it into something that is structured and queryable. And you find a lot of data that what I call are claims and assertions about the meaning of data. So a lot of the functional imaging databases are telling you the results of statistical analyses, that this area lights up and this doesn't. So they're not necessarily giving you the raw data, but they're giving you the results of analysis, because in order for you to get that, you would have to redo the analysis. You also see that there are a lot of databases which I call single source, and these are data that are acquired within a single context and framework. The Allen Brain Atlas, again, is an example of this. These tend to be very, very well populated and provide a really robust platform for analyzing an individual data set. You also have aggregators where they take the same type of data from multiple sources, so GenBank or the Protein Data Bank would be an example. And then you have a lot of registries. We've actually got hundreds of catalogs out there, all cataloging the same resources. And again, just saying a little bit about each one. So what types of questions would you actually like to be able to ask of something like a NIF? Well, I always like to point out to people that there really are two classes of questions. And of course, the ones we like the most as scientists is what is known. What are connections of new data? Is the answer to Alzheimer's disease already out there somewhere? And if I just connect the dots, I will find it. But a lot of the times when we sit in front of a search engine, we're looking for something that's actually known. And when I say known, I have all these asterisks there, because a lot of people in the semantic web say, I want to give you the precise answer. But to a research scientist, it means I want to give you access to all the data where you might be able to get some idea of what's going on there. So it's not about a yes or no, but can I return to you everything that might bear on that question? So questions like, what are the projections of the hippocampus? We know as data scientists, they may be right or wrong, but at least these have been recorded. And if somebody said something about a projection of the hippocampus, we'd like to know it. And this little slide here is really meant to indicate that most of this data is contained in these sort of silos, the literature being one of them, and that we really don't have this sort of tapestry to be able to answer them, because sometimes you actually need to go across multiple ones. So here's what NIF did. NIF said, all right, I'm going to get as many data sources as I can, and I'm going to allow you to query across them. And I don't think that anybody is surprised that that's not that easy to do. We know we have multiple terms for the same thing. We know that nobody uses a standard terminology. We're not even sure that there is a standard terminology which describes neuroscience. So the very first thing NIF put in was the ability to at least search for synonyms. So if you're going to look for the hippocampus and some resource talked about CA or CA1 or any of the other variants of it, you needed to be able to search for it. And not only just there, but again, we know that there are parts of hippocampus, and so some people might be talking about projections in CA3, and they're really talking about that. That is a true statement. If you're looking for projections of the hippocampus, you'd like to know what's in CA3. So NIF provided you the ability to expand to look at related things. And how we do that, I will show you in just a moment. But we also, again, organize things roughly by data type and level of the nervous system. We link back to the original source because we're a data federation. We also provided tutorials, because we found that every resource that's out there uses their own interface. They have their own logic. We don't yet have any sort of standardization like we do on Macs or almost a car or anything else that says you can have multiple brands of cars, but they all ought to work more or less the same way. We also found that again, there wasn't just one database covering a topic, but there often would be 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And that when you actually looked at them, they were all giving you the same type of information at some level. Then they would differentiate themselves down below. So NIF said, all right, well, we're neuroscientists, so let's try to organize these in a common framework. So it turns out that there are 6 connectivity databases that NIF knows about. If you went to each one individually, it might look something like this. This is what the actual result is if you returned from NIF to that database. And that's not very informative. It doesn't actually tell you anything about the connections of the hippocampus unless you know how that database works. If you actually go and look at all the different ways people talk about contacts, you see that there's all different levels in there and all different types of terminology that they're using. But NIF said, we're relatively confident that what you're really saying is that brain region A projects to brain region B, and that's the information we're going to take, and there's some projection strength and there's some technique. But in fact, you actually could unify across all these quite easily and provide this very simplified view. So we couldn't do that for everything, but we could do it for some things. And this really starts to show why some sort of coherent framework is really, really very important, even a simple semantic framework. And I call it, and those of you who saw my poster out there before, the scourge of neuroanatomical nomenclature. There is no shortage of ways for us to parcellate up the brain, and they are all legitimate ways of doing it. But in fact, if you're trying to go across databases, I think this really illustrates the extent of the problem. We have 7 databases now. We extracted all the unique anatomical terms that we found, excluding the avian brain, because you might expect that that might be a little bit different, even though they've realigned their terminology. And we asked the question, What exact terms appeared in more than one database? And the answer out of those 1,800 was 42. So only 42 terms were exactly the same between the two. If you added synonyms, you got up to about 100. If you added first-order partonymies, you got close to 400. So you could actually link these two data sets together much more richly, which you would do if you were a human being searching through there, because you would know this, than just going on a straight syntactic match. So NIF, through this, has developed what we call our minimum requirements to share data. If you're going to create a resource, you have to recognize that A, first people have to find it. They need to be able to know where it is. And you might say, well, that's stupid. Surely everybody knows about the Allen Brain Atlas, but the very first thing we did when we sat somebody down in front of NIF was, oh, I didn't know there was an Allen Brain Atlas. I didn't know there was a grants database from NIH. In fact, people don't know these things, and they're not that easy to find. You have to be able to use it. That is, you got to be able to access the data, and the data needs to be in a form that's appropriate. So we see a lot of resources where they give you pictures of tables, and pictures of tables don't help you very much, right? Pick tables should be numbers, and you should be able to operate on them. And you have to know what the data mean. And by this, I mean you need to have some semantics, you need to have some experimental context, and you have to have some idea of provenance. And there's been a lot of effort put in place to try to figure out exactly what you need, but the answer is if you don't have any, it becomes almost impossible to use the data. And some simple semantics are quite you know, straightforward in the sense that we see a lot of databases where the number 1 will stand for male, or the number 1 will stand for a brain region, or the number 1 will stand for present. Again, 1 means nothing outside of the context in which it's used, so we need to know what that is. We do a lot of translation. So what do we use to provide the semantic framework? Semantic framework we use is ontology. And I put the scream up here because this is an area that's extremely controversial, I would say, in the realm of science. And especially in neuroscience, people say, I don't need it, I don't want it. And I hope to convince you otherwise after this talk. But basically, ontology, in its essence, is a branch of philosophy. It's a theory of what is. So we all know at some level that we live in an analog world, at least at some level of granularity. But yet, we constantly divide things into different categories, and we talk about Platonic things and non-Platonic things, and it's been going on for thousands of years. How do humans know what these things are? How do we build models? How do we communicate about these models? And in the modern era of computer science, essentially an ontology is considered a formalization of this knowledge in a form that's machine computable. So it typically consists of a set of classes or concepts, whatever you want to call them, and they are related to each other through relations. So in a typical relational database, it might say that there's a table that has brain and a table that has cerebellum, and there's some relation between them. But in an ontology, these relations tend to be more formally specified and computed, such that a computer can do the same sorts of reasoning over it than you can. Okay? So it's usually some sort of logical formalism. And as I said, ontology is a very controversial area, and there's a lot of papers that are published that indicate it. One of the latest ones is War of the Ontologies, Worlds, Ontology as Mathematics, Computer Sciences, Esperanto. And it basically means that just like hippocampus, if I talk to somebody about ontology, it means different things to them. But we are clearly, in our realm, and this is true of most biomedical scientists, in the realm of Esperanto. Does everybody know what Esperanto is? Yeah, it was an attempt a long time ago to create sort of a universal language that could be used to translate amongst all the different languages. So it's sort of the Uber standard. So all you needed to know was Esperanto, and everything would be, it was kind of comprised of all the languages. And the reason why we really turn to ontologies is, I like to say, we don't have data types in neuroscience that tie us together. We don't have techniques in neuroscience that tie us together. We don't all do sequencing. We don't all do imaging. We don't all do physiology. We do a mixture of these things. And the thing that ties together the fact that you have a wave trace from an intracellular recording or an intracellular injection of a neuron or a gene expression pattern in the brain is the fact that they come from brains and neurons and hippocampus. It's the concepts that we use. It's the only thing that we use that actually ties us all together. We don't have anything else that does it. So ontology is really a way for us to express this general knowledge in a way that can be used by an information system to help us with the fact that there is no standard and there is no good way of putting everything together. It allows us to identify each class by a unique identifier. I'm going to show you why that's important. It allows us to aggregate synonyms and lexical variants. Ontology doesn't really care what you call something as long as it resolves to something that we know what it means. It provides means of disambiguations for strings, so nucleus part of cell, nucleus part of brain, nucleus part of atom are all three distinct things. And it also allows us to perform reasoning. It allows us to link data through relationships, not just to one-to-one. So the relationship between CA1 and hippocampus is specified and can be used. And I think the main thing, the best explanation of why it's important in information science was given to me by my own ontologist when he said, if you think about ontologies, ontologies express the universals that bind together all these numbers and bits and other things that are sitting all over the globe. So that's what makes them powerful. So what are the power of unique identifiers? Why do we want them? We tend to use strings, we talk in strings, we write in strings, but we all know when we do a Google search that strings are ambiguous. So just to use myself as an example, as an instance of a person, if you query PubMed for M. Martone, you get all of these articles. And some of them are M. E. Martone, and some are M. Martone, and some are... I think those are the only two, M. Martone and M. E. Martone. And you might say, well, I can look at the subject matter, I can look at the area around it, and I will be able to tell you exactly which ones belong to you. So you might say, oh, here's amnesia, here's microscopy, I know she's a microscopist, here's ontologies, okay, that's probably her. Oh, gene wiki, that sounds like something she would do. Brain injury, well, okay, fine. Here's the amnesia, maybe these two guys are related to each other. And this one over here is in caudate nucleus, I don't know exactly where that means, but all right, maybe it's right here in brain. But in fact, if you want to know which ones are mine, I'll tell you which ones are mine, and this reflects the different stages of my career. And even though I've been in UCSD a long time, I didn't do the same thing in UCSD, and I wasn't there my entire life. So in fact, this person down here is my cousin Marilyn, who actually does work in traumatic brain injury. This person is a stray M. Martone who found his way into the biomedical literature and was not there a few years ago because I didn't have to worry about it. So there are various people who basically are writing things like, well, I'm not a number, but maybe I should be a number. Because once I'm uniquely identified by a number, and numbers are cheap, you can say, well, it doesn't matter what your string is. You can call yourself whatever you want. You can call yourself by your name, your initials, your abbreviations, but I've identified you, and therefore I can use you to pull out interesting information. I'm not telling you necessarily what the information means, but at least I've given you the information space that pertains to you as an individual. So they become very powerful things because they allow us to link information across systems. So NIFA spend a lot of time trying to develop ontologies and import ontologies that have already been developed by others to provide a loose semantic framework for neuroscience. We cover the major domains of neuroscience. We have them down to a certain level of granularity. And again, the question is always, well, can you use that to disambiguate concepts just like you can to disambiguate people? And it's perfectly, I think, legitimate for you to know that, again, you could say we studied calcium-binding proteins in CA2 neurons in low-calcium conditions. CA2 means something different in each one of these circumstances. And it's not that difficult for us to just say, okay, well, CA2 hippocampal area has one unique identifier, and CA2 as calcium has another unique identifier. And these come from all different ontologies that have already been developed. In order to expose these and to make it easy for people to generate these, we've created something like the Neuralex Wiki, which is based on the same software as Wikipedia, but with a more semantic underpinning. So anytime you register a concept there, because we don't have it, it says, oh, here's your unique identifier, and it can be used. We also use these ontologies, again, in a conceptual sense. And so a lot of the things that we have, we can define. So if I'm searching a lot of data for GABAergic neuron, I, as a cellular biologist, know all the different types of neurons that might use GABA. But an information system doesn't know that unless it explicitly references it. So NIF automatically translates the concepts that it's comfortable with into things that are helpful for search. So NIF clearly falls down on the line of ontologies as Esperanto. And we believe that that's the only thing that really makes it practical. We make all our ontologies available via web services, but if you don't want to use ours, there's other places that do them. But it basically says it's not just enough to have an ontology identifier, but it should be a shared identifier, a community identifier that everybody can use, because that allows you to create your resource in a way that much makes it much more interoperable. So if we have everything aligned, what could we do with it? What sort of questions? You might say, I don't know, that looks like a lot of garbage you got in there. Maybe we need to generate all new data, and all that data is not useful for anything. And one of the things that we like to say is it's very hard for you to know exactly how people are going to want to use your resource. We assume, again, that people are going to come and use it exactly the way you intended for the purpose you intended. But as you've seen in this marvelous flowering of creativity on the web, even these lovely films that we saw, people will use these things for different things, and it's impossible for you to predict what they're going to do. So in NIF, we've started to do things like landscape analysis, where we've said, well, let's look at all the brain regions we have, and let's look at all the resources we have, and see what is the coverage of major brain regions. You see that there are some resources that have very deep coverage. You also see that there are some brain structures that are heavily overrepresented across all the resources, but obviously the landscape is not uniform. And again, I want to put a caveat that what we really are talking about here is not necessarily all that is known, that there's still literature, images, and human knowledge, but that small portion that was structured so that we can actually look at it. But that leads to interesting biases. So if we look again at the representation, we see there's a lot of information about cerebral cortex, not so much in terms of absolute records of these other areas. So in this area here, we know that this probably doesn't reflect complete reality. There's probably a lot more information known, and NIF just doesn't have it. In other areas, we quite clearly are comprehensive. We have, for example, about 900,000 organisms, about 200,000 model organism databases. But just because it's a biased data set doesn't mean it's a useless data set, because in some cases, we do want to know about bias. NIH asked us, what is the representation of male versus female in data resources? And because our animal data is dominated by the resources coming out of Allen, and because Allen was using males, in fact, a lot of the analysis that we're doing are being done on males. And that's a bias, but perhaps one that should be corrected. So what have we learned? What we have learned in looking across the landscape, NIF was originally created to avoid duplication of effort. And I think we really don't know enough about what's going on in this very brave new world that we live in for us to avoid duplication of effort, whether it's because you didn't know it was there, it wasn't good enough, it didn't do exactly what you wanted, it didn't cover the domain. We see that there are multiple databases that are produced for multiple contexts. They contain partially overlapping data, if not completely overlapping data. Data flows from one resource to the next where it gets transformed, reinterpreted, and analyzed. And so if you can't beat duplication, the question is, can we make use of the duplication? And again, if we use these identifiers and if we use these hooks with spatial frameworks, then we can start adding things together in interesting ways and take advantage. So in this case, we had two databases on fMRI from the literature. They gave us PubMed IDs. The PubMed ID is that unique identifier that's given to each biomedical article really nice identifier, we could pull out all of the statements that were made about papers that were done between the two, and we could see that they sort of complemented each other and added value to each other. Some of them gave us Brodmann's areas, others gave us tasks. They both didn't model the information the same way. This one, I think, is more interesting in that this took the same data set. We said, I wonder if anybody's analyzed the same data set across all these different databases we have. We have 9 microarray databases. And it turned out a couple of resources did take the same data set and do reanalysis on it. Now, it wasn't easy to pull this out of NIF because, again, people weren't using the identifiers. We had to do a lot of mapping and things. But what we found was there were 2 databases, the drug-related gene database and GEMMA. Drug-related gene database had pulled statements from supplementary material that were related to gene expression as a function of drugs of abuse. GEMMA just takes all gene expression data from the GEO resource and reanalyzes it. So we found some interesting things. After doing some alignments by taking gene IDs and other sorts of things, which again took us a long time, we aligned the 2 data sets and found about 1,300 statements that were in common between the 2 of them. We also found that in the beginning they were 100% opposite of each other, that every gene that one went up in one went down in the other. And we said, well, that can't possibly be the case. Well, it turns out GEMMA had a machine do it, and it reported saline relative to morphine as opposed to morphine relative to saline. This was done by humans. Humans would never do that. So after we got everything aligned and looked, we saw that actually over half the claims of the paper were not confirmed in this reanalysis. Now, we don't know which one is right or wrong, but I think we do need to start thinking about the fact that, well, having more people access this data maybe is a very powerful way to deal with some of the fact that we know that reproducibility is hard. So taking in what I call a global view on data and transforming our microculture to an ecosystem-based view, we have to think about several powerful trends that are underway and really enabled by the web. The web is not just about networking data or documents, it's also about networking people. And maybe we need to start thinking again, not only about producing our data for our colleagues and ourselves and our own thesis work, but more as part of this global infrastructure so that, in fact, we can ask interesting questions, we can make use of the wisdom of the crowds, we have multiple ways of dealing with it, and again, recognizing that data may not, the use of data may not be directly related to what you wanted to do, but what they wanted to do. So just to finish up, I think I got 15 seconds and I'll be right on time. We think that the future of scientific communication really does involve this very large cultural shift. Oh, that's my alarm. Okay, sorry. I wanted to make sure I didn't go over. So the future of scientific communication, we know it's a very rapidly changing landscape, and people think that artificial agents like Watson will push us out of business. I think that that's actually a while in coming, particularly for scientific data. But we've learned over many hundreds of years how to write scientific papers for others and maybe a few people to index it. We now have to learn how to report data in papers for people to read, and we have to learn how to publish data in a form on a suitable platform so that it is served best. And it may not be served best by a paper. It may be served by some other medium. We need to be able to master the medium. And just as a final one, why does it matter? Again, those of you who have been at the whole conference may have heard this paper referenced, but I do really think it is quite damning that when people tried to replicate major papers in cancer biology from top journals, they couldn't replicate over 70% of them. And if you read deeply, one of the biggest reasons is there's no guidelines that require anything about data, where to put it, where to make it accessible, or even whether you need to make it accessible at all. And I think there is a crisis in science and confidence developing, and we as scientists have to clean our own shop. So, just to finally conclude, I like to point out, because people are often confused by what NIF is. Many people think that we are a data platform, that we're an NCBI or we're an EBI, and we are not, and our budget is nowhere near it. NIF is not meant to replace all these different infrastructures. NIF is designed to allow them to work together. Because just as we needed to have a PubMed to be able to query across all the biomedical literature, it would be very helpful if we could query across all biomedical data to use it for whatever purpose you wish to use it. Okay? So I thank you. And I just want to note a group that was mentioned is Force 11, which is the future of research communications, because I do actually believe this is a global problem, and there are people who are getting together to work on this. And now you can applaud because I'm done. That wasn't too bad. Yes.
Here. I admire your efforts to tackle a rather complex problem, but I cannot help but feeling that rather than reinventing the wheel, we should learn from some examples that have worked, bioinformatics, genomics, and so on. And one of the reasons that it worked so well over the last many decades is that journals said, well, if you want to publish, you need to put the data in a very specific format.
Yes.
And I fail to believe that we cannot do that in neuroscience. I agree that there are many different scales, different techniques, and so on, but we can define a couple of specific formats and have journals and maybe even NIH say, well, you want to get a grant, then you need to publish your data. You want to write a paper, and it has to be in these two or three very specific, well-described databases.
Yeah, so that's an excellent point. And again, there are people across town as part of INCF trying to develop some of those minimal standards. I think people have tried to do this over the last decade, but there were two things that were missing in neuroscience. One was mechanism. That is, there weren't a lot of databases and places where you could put them, or data archives like DataCite or other data repositories. So people could always use that as an excuse. Those excuses are going away. Also, I think that, again, We all made mistakes when developing minimal metadata standards, because if the minimal metadata standards are 40 pages long, you're not going to follow them. And I think people have gotten a lot better at saying, what's truly minimal data? But you'll be happy to know that the Society for Neuroscience, NIF, and NIH are putting a big push on to the neuroscience journal saying, you know what? It's time, okay? Because otherwise it will never happen.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I've been sort of loosely involved in these initiatives in the past 10 years or so, and been rather frustrated on this, and I'd like to tell you an anecdote. There was a big consortium in the US that I met on one of the CNS meetings, and after the talk I asked them, well, what kind of people do you have in the consortium? And among 22 researchers that are working there, 20 were out of the computer science and engineering.
Yeah, that is a problem.
And two were loosely in medicine. And the result of the consortium was accordingly.
Yes.
And the other thing is the funding agency, very many of them say we are sort of startup funders. After 5 years or so, you have to see where the money comes from. My computer, however, doesn't even run for 5 years with that amount of data. Who do you think will fund this?
Ah, so that's an interesting question.
I mean, stably, long-term, without renewing a grant every other year.
So the reason that I actually agreed, I have been involved in many of those types of projects, exactly the ones you were talking about, and found it extremely frustrating that you needed access to advanced computer science, but if you didn't have the domain scientists there saying, this is what we need, or testing the system, because oftentimes the PIs were uninvolved and would not even know what was going on underneath them as they were running around the world saying, oh, we're so fabulous. So when I set up the NIF, I set it up again to be to sort of a direct reaction to all these projects. And the heads are the neuroscientists, and half our staff are what I call the sort of softer side, in the sense that we're people who are actually trying to answer neuroscience questions through the infrastructure. And we get constant feedback saying, you know, you haven't done this right, you haven't done this right. It's not meaningful, because the computer scientists will go spin off into hyperspace forever. And it's a hard job wrangling them, and we've made some missteps because of it. But again, I believe this is all the process. The other reason I took NIF on, believe it or not, was because built into the contract was a sustainability clause. And I said, if we can't figure out what the sustainability model is for these things, then why do we keep building them? Well, one answer is, again, that's why we wanted to populate as quickly as possible, so that even if there was no sustainability model or not a need for one, because that was possible, that we'd at least leave behind a legacy of some useful information that couldn't have been gotten before, not just why it's too difficult to get people to share their data. I thought that was an uninteresting lesson because we'd learned it already. So I think that what we did in NIF is we've said, listen, you know, we've looked really deeply at what the value of data are, and we've tried to present this to NIH to say, yeah, if you're going to fund a huge data infrastructure, that is expensive. NIF is not that expensive. And we actually gather back some of our data from grantees who want to use it, but also realize that if they do have a data sharing requirement, and some of them do, they don't want to spend half their budget with their computer science colleagues. They'd rather be able to give it to NIF for a fraction of the cost and say, here, you have it. But NIF's true sustainability will come in when data publishing becomes equivalent to narrative publishing, and therefore the costs for that are passed on to the grantees, just like you have page charges now. You can have page charges passed on to the grantees. So we've been quite clear that we're sort of in another world. The other good thing is that nonprofits and others do have a vested interest in making sure their data are available. And those are a lot of sustainers for NIF, because they're not afraid, the SMA Foundation and others, to say, if you don't share the data we pass pay for, we're just not going to fund you again, whereas NIH has been very reluctant to do that. So it's sort of a mixture of a model, but it is a very important one, and again, that's one of the reasons we've done our best to hold the cost down. If you go to them and tell you it's going to cost them, you know, you need another EBI, they're not going to do it. If you say maybe two or three R01s, well, that might work. But that also means NIF is not all it could be, and we're looking through industry to say, you know, is there an economic model here for our data? Sure.
In the Carmen initiative, there was, for example, a part of the code from which was proprietary to a company.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
no,
after
we don't
the
like
funding
those.
Run out, and or let's say the company sort of ended the contract, then what happens to this? So if you want an industry model, I think this is bound to fail.
Well, I think the industry model is there are, somebody's got to pay at some point. Or, again, globally, we have to decide what type of an asset are these data. And I think the answer right now is it's hard to know. It's hard to know exactly what they're going to be valuable for and how much money we should spend on trying to keep them in play on spinning disk in perpetuity. And what we keep telling everybody from NIF is you have to make some choices here. You know, you cannot host all of it equally well across all of the different resources that are there. But in terms of that sort of model, there are negotiations and things that you can make with companies and others whose mandate it is to make things open. There are plenty of foundations and other sorts of .orgs out there whose job it is to make things open at a base level and then charge incrementally as you want to use more and more and more of their services. And those sort of freemium models, I think, are reasonable ones to explore. But I don't know that any of them will work. And again, until somebody really tried to do this on a large scale, we wouldn't even know what questions to ask of them. And how much would it really realistically cost? You know, again, how valuable are these data? What discoveries are being made in them? So I actually think that it's a shared responsibility of government, institutions, organizations, all kinds of things. You see that institutions are setting up their own data repositories, so we don't have to foot the bill for that. We just have to be able to search across them. The curator expertise and others, well, you can contract out to India now to do it for a fraction of the cost that it would involve the United States. So I actually do think that the costs are going down, but this database sustainability part, is a huge problem, and we have not solved it yet.
Final question. This is scoped on neuroscience, but next door is computational neuroscience, next door is computer science, next door is mathematics and engineering. Are there such projects for other fields? You can't draw a line anywhere, I think. Are there other projects? Do you know of them? And do you plan to interlink with them
one
day, maybe?
So NIF's view, again, is it's not that there's one thing up here that aggregates everything, but that anybody who's gotten any kind of money to bring some order to the chaos should actually work together to sort of harmonize as much as they can. So we try to harmonize whenever possible. But we also have kind of sold the idea to NIH partially. And believe me, you've got to go through all sorts of political fiefdoms because there's reasons why people want to fund their own, and I had to cut that slide out for time. But we actually said to the NIDDK, Digestive Diseases, who put out a call to do something exactly like NIF, we're like, why doesn't NIF do that? You can already use all our infrastructure. Half of our resources are already relevant to you anyway. Why do you want to fund this again? And for once, I was actually shocked. NIH agreed with us, and they're like, yeah, why don't we put up an NIDDK? Why don't we start to look at how we can create a more uniform resource layer? Because that also lowers the cost for other people trying to get in, access the data, and make use of it. Because that's the other, again, thing about NIF, is NIF just says, if you can take a subset of it and make it better and use it for your domain, bravo, just make sure you keep the identifier that lets us know that the data are there, and if we need it for anything, we can go there. So what NIF is really getting into now is there are huge cultural differences between these different groups. They don't talk about the same things. They don't value the same things. And how are we going to rank and show this uniform resource layer appropriately to different groups so that it has value to them? And it's a big challenge. But again, I think we have the footing to allow us to even start to say, how might this be done?
Thanks again. And if you want to interact more with Marianne probably later on and you see her enthusiasm, energy,
that's right.
Which I think is a very important goal for the entire community. And in some way, the next speaker will also address this. And I thank you.
Oh, thank you.